Yeah, I'll come with you, Johnny.
No, you can go back to her.
I mean, if I was writing a flat-out history, you know, by V.S. In Laos or something like that,
what?
The way I would describe it is had this gradual encroachment of the USAID mission and USAID mission until it's simply absorbed by V.S.
Yeah.
Right. But the point is that they were equated from the beginning because conditions in Laos made it impossible to do anything without USAID.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get food, you couldn't get transportation, you couldn't get anything. So the two were identical in IVS, which is what you pointed out in the article. But then you see this as the CIA and USAID gear up for a war, then IVS is almost swallowed up by that war. And that's where Fred and others begin saying, IVS has no legitimate mission here. But can I point something out to you? After Laos becomes communist in 1975, there were at least 6 aid workers who weren't with IVS but who had been IVS volunteers and ran UNICEF and UN Refugee Program. Those were all IVSers, and they were now under the rubric of the communists, you know, and felt that they were now serving the rightful government of Laos.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, they're participating in the pacification effort to establish the Pathet Lao government, if you want to look at it that way.
Well, yeah. Like I say, I saw that the American anti-war movement drifting inevitably in that direction at one point, you know, where they were taking orders from the North Vietnamese government.
Yeah.
Well, you just get drawn into, once you get a war going like that, you get drawn into one side or the other.
Of course, there'll be a real big effort in the next few years to make it sound as if the anti-war movement was actually run by Moscow, which shows you how little perspective Americans know how to have. In fact, I've already been asked that.
Oh, yeah, well, that's good. So that's what makes your work valuable.
Yes, because you have to say, no, it wasn't like this.
No, here was this guy.
No, it wasn't like that.
Yeah.
It was like this. This is reality.
Yeah, here are these guys. They have chaotic minds, and they're doing this and that. But this is not it. They're not taking orders from Moscow. And there was a Holocaust in Europe and so on.
Yes, you're right.
You have to keep repeating
to keep repeating these realities. But I think now you can appreciate actually why we were talking about that.
But I got to trip you in here, man. This is like a little slice of Pop Buell's Last Day in IVS, written by Galen Roll. Mm-hmm. Galen Barry. Galen Barry, yeah. But what I wanted to say...
No, let's see. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Should I talk to Dan?
Yeah.
I'm vitamin C.
Oh, no, thanks.
Oh, this is trippy. I still got this.
Yeah, I'll take some vitamin C. Give me 5,000 kids.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, Jesus, look at this. It all started, he gave his background, with a recent Lao Army victory at Atapo. The Air Force gained an advantage by shooting rockets at villages harboring Pathet Lao troops. This is really effective. The villagers were all shook up and sent delegations to ask the Chau Mon, you know, the province chief, to stop having their villages strafed. The PL are boiling mad since they're losing their hold on the people, and they started shooting at planes all over the place. That was progress.
This is a community development volunteer in Laos,
yes,
man.
Yes. Yeah. Pot was part of the machine.
People to people.
Well, people to people, absolutely.
Well, you got into this by the guy who said, we're sugar.
I was supposed to chew on that, wasn't I?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
You tried to swallow
it. I just swallowed it.
I know. Think of all the fly shit that might be on it, too.
No, I don't mean that.
Oh, okay.
What's going to happen now? Let's see.
No, if you're flying, you might as well dissolve.
You know the Heimlich maneuver, of course.
If you're still talking, it's cool, man. Mm-hmm. The rest of your body can deal with it. If it's gone past...
Yeah, it's just gone, it's gone.
You're still running your
rap.
That was fun.
I enjoyed that. That was great. Because I'm used to taking really big stuff, you know, like malaria pills, things like that. It used to be really big.
But...
So. By the way, did you take any malaria pills when you were in Vietnam?
Oh, yeah, geez, I take every kind of pill, you know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it was real obvious to me that I was just, these Montagnards were headed into genocide the way that they were at, and I was just, like, sugarcoating for it, you know. I mean, that was really, Gittleson really wrapped it up, that I was kind of, like, doing this day-to-day stuff, But the real thing to do is to get the Americans the hell out of there. That was step A. And now they've been through like step B, C, and D. They've been through a heavy-duty communist regime. And this has given them all a big headache. So now there are American corporations running around the country. My daughter's a tourist there. And we're getting something like, you know, a Vietnam where somebody can have kind of like a reasonable, happy life, maybe, you know. But the first thing was to get this crazy military machine out of there.
Why? I know that sounds like a stupid question, and I know the answer. But why was the most important thing to get the military machine out?
Imagine it in your town, you know, you're trying to go about your business, and like Pop just said, oh, well, they shot a few rockets into the village, and it's got the peasants all riled up, you know? I mean, what the fuck, you know, get real, you know, it's so, I don't know, this is the thing, to Americans, it's something that's happening overseas, it's happening on television, you can't feel it, somebody shoots a rocket into your house, nobody can imagine it, you know? The peasants are riled up because they shot a few rockets into the town, you know?
Like casual saying.
Well, yeah. No, the point is that the Americans don't understand this. And they don't see it.
They never will.
People said, hey, but then the communists will take over. And then they invented a concept that there would be a bloodbath to justify continuing the war. That is, ending the war would lead to a communist victory, which would be more terrible than what was happening in Vietnam during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And...
There
wasn't a bloodbath, but people, like in all complex things, people suffered horribly. Individuals suffered horribly, and thousands suffered horribly. But the argument that a historian like me would make is that it was a civil war, and people were always going to suffer horribly. We just ensured that 10% of the population died in it, and ensured that millions more suffered by prolonging
it.
That's what I think.
Some just got killed immediately.
No, the point is people who even worked for the United States government, who'd had a Fulbright or had gone to the United States on a training mission, were deprived of their livelihood, were put forced labor, but more importantly, they weren't allowed to work. They weren't allowed to have lives. And for maybe 10 or 15 years, they couldn't actively do anything but barely feed themselves.
Yeah, that's what keeps me from going back there, that and all the turncoat dreams I had for years after. When I got into the anti-war movement, I'd go in the bunker with my old friends there, and suddenly they'd look at me, I was a traitor, you know, I'd thrown in with the other side.
Right.
I'd joined the anti-war movement, I'd joined the Viet Cong.
Oh, and glad we got to that, yeah.
And I would have this dream,
mm-hmm.
And I'm still just completely, I'm afraid of my emotional reaction going back to where I was at.
Mm-hmm.
Because I might see somebody that I knew, you know. And I really don't know how it would come out. I may actually do it. I haven't wanted to travel anywhere. I did so much flying and stuff during those years, I don't even want to get on a plane. I just kind of stay around.
It's really dangerous to do that now.
And so, like, you had to come here to rap with me. And,
that makes me a little sick, actually.
Yeah.
The songs to the loss of life, like it's a terrorist act.
Yeah, so
just so horrible. But if it isn't, you know. But
so there wasn't any good conclusion to it, you know.
No.
I mean, at all. But I'm glad I did what I did in terms of the anti-war movement, just to get the whole American thing out of there because it was so brutal and stupid. It was just tearing the whole place apart. I mean, just murderous monstrosity. Mindless. I lost all respect for somebody with a suit and a tie and a large government job. These people can see black and say white. I mean, it's just, once you get that kind of like mindless program mentality. And the IVS got just sucked into it, drawn into it. And yeah, at first it was like Pop Buell. He went totally with the program. Then it was like me and Freddie. We went totally against it, you know. Either way, it was the program, you know. And it wasn't anything like the initial concept of an international volunteer. It was completely something else.
You file, I mean, you mentioned that Don spoke to you and said, you know, we'd never send people like you with IBS today. Have you followed the kind of changes that have gone on in IBS? Do you get their newsletter?
No, I'm totally cut off. I had no idea there was an IBS Alumni Association or something. I just, Chris Jenkins is a good friend of mine, so Don Luce came out and had an event at his house a few years ago, and so I went to that. That's when I saw Don. But some of my closest friends are still from those days. And not necessarily holding the same political opinions I do. But just close friends. War buddies, you know. Chris and Tuyet, real good friends of mine.
Yes, they're wonderful people.
Yeah. Yeah, we distribute our seaweed every 6 weeks in the city, and we stay at their place a lot, you know.
No, great. Well, any last reflections? That was very eloquent, what you just said.
Mm.
That's the kind of stuff we wanted in these oral history interviews.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've said a lot of them. Well, I ask these niggly questions.
Yeah, to me it amazes me how much the emotion comes back to me when I start talking about this, even though I live in a completely different scene. Most of my friends now don't really know I was in Vietnam. But it comes back. So it was a very, life-transforming experience. And I love the IBS. I just love watching what happens to the characters who were in it, you know, like Tom Amiens is one of my favorite guys, you know. I mean, a gay comedian who's a supervisor of San Francisco. Herb Bruce would probably talk to you too. He's also one of the most interesting people I've ever met in my life. He's in Pennsylvania, I think. Hamilton Jordan was an IBS volunteer.
He went home fairly soon, though, didn't he?
I don't know anything about it, but
sick.
I just know.
Yeah, he was sick a lot, and I think he went back fairly soon.
Mm-hmm.
He's in my part of the country, I mean, at least in Georgia, so I'll try to... He's not on the... I don't think he didn't respond to the Alumni Association letter. Mm-hmm. Tony Lake, of course, the president's national security advisor. Mm-hmm. Was director of IBS after the war.
Oh.
Actually, I think he was head of IBS when the war ended. I don't know whether that was Peters or him. But Tony Lake was a vice counsel in Hawaii during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly absorbed all the lessons of the Vietnam War. And nonetheless, under Carter, read the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia as Vietnamese imperialism. And that's what you're talking about right there. The paradigms and programs that people bought into. That the Vietnamese were the bad guys, so if they invade Cambodia, they must be bad guys, you know, doing bad things.
Well, it's funny you said that, because I agree with him completely. And that's where Tuyet gets pissed off at me, because the thing is, there are so many different angles and experiences. I live with the Cham people. Who'd been overrun by the Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And so I got a whole view of Vietnamese history as overrunning and assimilating people. Mm-hmm. And as a theoretician, I saw that the French had arrested the Vietnamese assimilation of Cambodia. They arrested it, they stopped it. Mm-hmm. And that I predicted that as soon as the war was over, it would continue to its ultimate conclusion, which is the Vietnamese would assimilate Cambodia. And so...
Yeah, it's a valid perception.
So, me and Tony Lake, see?
No, Tony Lake now disagrees.
Oh, well, okay, so then...
Tony Lake now says the intelligence information they should have listened to then, and which they have now, was the Vietnamese were responding to a Cambodian attack.
Well, there are shades of truth. Oh, see, there are shades of reality. If you really know Vietnamese history and culture, you know that it's not going to sleep until Cambodia is Vietnamese. I mean, you talk about Vietnamization.
Well,
they can go in and they ban the Cham language. They intermarry. They prohibit the practice of the religious customs.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon, like within a few generations, everybody's Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. They've been doing this for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least since 1452 or something.
Yeah, long time.
Long time.
So, yeah.
But
and this is where I get, you know, like,
yeah.
This is where, like, the radical theoreticians get pissed off at me. So get this guy out of here.
Well, I think what those radical theoreticians should remember is that there are no heroic countries. If you just think of that, then what happens in Cambodia or not is irrelevant. If the question is Vietnam is going to look after its national interests and do bad things, as all nations do, Cambodia will do the same thing. The stronger party will win. Maybe not. Bad luck, international environment, all sorts of things apply. I mean, China got involved with the Khmer Rouge, backing them against Vietnam.
Yeah.
That was a big game that they played, invaded Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
All those things are just part of what countries do. So either you know, when you start putting one country above another, which is what the left did after the war, they tried to walk away from Vietnam, pretended, well, we did that. We got America out. It's not of our business anymore. We don't care about Khmer Rouge, you know. Khmer Rouge are freedom-loving peoples fighting an American-backed dictatorship without thinking about what the consequences are or who the Khmer Rouge were. People do that. That doesn't make the anti-war movement nasty. Their view was, let's get out of there. And naturally, if you're going to say, let's get out of there, you're going to make heroes into the people who are pushing us out. That's what we're going to do. Of course, as you just mentioned, it's kind of hard to say what the anti-war movement was doing when its leaders were either communist factions or agents of the federal or state governments or local police forces. And that's my take, because I was there too. And
yeah.
I came to the exact conclusion that you did
yeah.
by close personal observation
right.
and ran as far away as I could into something else, overseas
right.
actually.
Yeah.
Because it was obvious that
yeah.
the anti-war movement, even at the local level, was totally supported
yeah.
by
mm-hmm.
not radical groups. I consider Stalinists radicals. That's like saying, Ronald Reagan is a conservative, you know, whatever.
Yeah, but out here it was rebuilt by the Quakers.
Yeah.
And that was cool, man. That was good. We're still going with them.
Yes, but, you know, it's sad, and it's part of the, it's something we need to learn from.
It's part of the great human adventure.
It's a human adventure,
jeez.
Right. So, there's no, it's not really, but what I guess as a historian, though, your problem is that your job is to get the record straight. So that people have the, what do you call it, eventually you always put on your own overlay, because every even generation reinterprets the past differently. But it's just a struggle just to see things clearly enough to understand what things were in the first place. And in war, of course, nothing is what it seems. And so the result is it's a struggle. What I like is that these days there are at least a few people who are struggling in trying to understand what happened in Vietnam. Instead
mm-hmm.
of simply falling into these convenient ways of categorizing things.
Yeah. Well, I hope you guys scramble this onto publication, because we got our computers now and everything, and we can, you
do
know,
you have a,
we can publish.
No, no,
because,
we'll have no problem getting this published, I don't think. I wouldn't imagine we'd have any trouble getting it published.
Good, because, you know, then it gets it to where somebody can read it. Because the IVS does have a perspective, I think, that hasn't come up that much.
Well, John, let me write down here. I don't have your zip code. Or
yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, I'm going to make up a email mailing list
mm-hmm.
and keep everybody informed as to, you know, where it's going.
Cool.
And you know, it occurs to me it might be fun to put any manuscript we develop. Of course, it'd have to be 10K. My machine, and just send it around to everybody for comment. That would be fun. That's doable. In 10K segments, because my email system won't handle, at least at the moment, won't handle more than 10.
Yeah, maybe, but as somebody who's done this kind of business, you interview them and then you do your best and lay it out there and then just because
yeah, but
I don't know.
Yeah, but the point is it's...
All that second guessing...
Second guessing is fun, though. If I was writing this, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But we're not doing this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is an oral history record.
Mm-hmm.
People have a right to say, not I didn't mean that, but I didn't say that. Mm-hmm. And then you can say, well, here's the tape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is there something you'd like to add to it? And he says, well, what I was thinking of that when I said that was this. And then we can change it to say, while musing on the da-da-da-da, and the context changes. You're entitled to that, I think. I don't say we'll do it. Simply say, you may be entitled to do that.
Okay, so I get it. Yeah, you're a tenured professor. You can do all this stuff. You know, I crank my thing out, got to send it in Tuesday, and then Wednesday I'll be writing about something else. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, it's not done.
I'm a journalist.
Yeah, that's right. I am doing it in a way for a living. That's what I do, but it's a profession.
You're probing around.
Yeah, probing
getting
around.
Different angles and so on. That's cool.
And trying to see it, because the point is that it should stimulate people to think. You know, that's what it's all about. And if it does that, then it works. And I've always found that, you know, pat answers, things that don't have the intrigue, where people don't have to grapple, they don't learn anything. So when you set up the grappling, when you see people struggling with truth, you struggle with it too, which is your point, for example, in writing that article, is to make people see something that they didn't see in another configuration. The data was manipulated so they didn't see the way the data now looks. And when they look at the way the data now looks, they have to reevaluate.
Mm-hmm.
They have to say, am I going to go on believing this? And that's the whole point. Well, it's what politics is all about, but it's also what education is about, in essence. So, we'll see. I love the posure of the objective professorial thing, but there is no such thing. But for an oral history, I think, in other words, if I don't create a space for an anti-communist, dyed-in-the-wool, as you said, Bible-bearing whatever person, to be able to tell their story, then we're not. It's not a legitimate effort.
Right.
So when you talk, I'm on that side. I'm on the hey, but that wasn't it right to do that? And
yeah.
Then when I'm talking to them,
actually,
it's, didn't you see yourself serving an international interest that was pro-capitalist? And they can say, well, so.
Well, just see that was Pop Buell's Christmas letter,
yeah.
And just take the consciousness from which. And to which he was writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just changed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of us.
Right.
That's because of us. We just got in there and just tore a big hole in it, you know. And now these guys are backed off. They realize they may still feel that way, but they're from that consciousness. It's still there somewhere, but it isn't dominant anymore, you know. But
well, do you think it can come back?
Oh, definitely. Everything kind of like... I've seen so many weird things. I mean, you know, Reagan coming in, geez, you know, and Dole. Yeah, sure. Yeah, the whole crusade thing. In a way, it's like I'm saying that I'm asserting that within Vietnamese culture and history, there's this assimilation thing, which means that if I watch them long enough, they're going to assimilate Cambodia. You know, maybe not this year, 10 years, 20 years, whatever. And then you're saying, well, this consciousness that Pop Buell was writing from, he's here I am, I'm over here with the U.S. It's like a World War II movie, right? You know, here I am with our boys on the front lines. And we're trying to save these people who are being overrun by the Hun, you know. And
we want to take away their culture.
Yeah, we're using everything we got. We parachute in with rice, you know, and so on. And I'm just wish you have it so much better over there. And I'm just wishing you a merry and a peaceful Christmas so that you don't have to live like these people do. And we're trying to just give them a little bit, a few modicum of toilets, which they need, you know, and so on. And...
But they lived all this time without it, right?
So there's that consciousness there.
They also have, high death rates because of
disease.
Right.
And me and Freddie are there, you know. We've been sent in by this consciousness. And we look out the window, and there's a spooky bird hosing down a family of six who's trying to take a swim in a free fire zone.
Or just wipe out the village that you just left.
Yeah, or they...
Don't toilet it.
Yeah. Or they actually, what happened in my area was the spooky bird made a little mistake. You know, it ran over a corner of the village. And nobody was prepared for that. Their bunkers were all for horizontal flying bullets, you know. And so it killed several of them, boy. And Vietnamese are cool. They would just be seething with rage, but the guy who would express their rage would be the old guy, the really old man. He would have the social persona say, listen, you know, what did you guys do? What are you doing? This is just crazy. You know? And we want to back you, but you're just killing everybody. You're blowing up the place. You know, you're tearing down the houses and everything's being destroyed. And how can we support, you know, this kind of thing? And that was obviously what was happening. It was getting worse and worse. To me, the only thing was get the Americans out, you know, and then let the dust settle. But that wasn't, like I say, I'm seeing that you have a problem in that the guys who are still kind of in that old consciousness, who are IVS guys, are not really as inclined as I am to get in your face with their rap, you know? Well, okay, yeah. Let them dig a bigger bunker, man. You know, that's okay with me.
Well, what'll be fun is the thing about Laos, and eventually we have to get to the Laos thing, is that Galen is one of the people I interviewed originally. And what I want to do is take his transcript with transcripts of people like Fred and parse it out, because sometimes these differences, especially in Galen's case, I know, these differences aren't that great, even in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So people know what's going on, but they have a different reason for being invested in it. But, you know, the point is, you could read, you know, Galen looked up, you know, when Fred, I guess it was 69, when you were there, almost when you were there, when Fred had this meeting and said, we got to invite the Path at Lao. Were you there then?
Mm-hmm.
So we got to invite the Path at Lao into our discussions.
Like I say, when I was there, Freddie was the most laid-back figure in world history.
But Fred said, we've got to involve the Path at Lao, otherwise we're going to make ourselves targets. They won't be able to tell us from USAID. We're too close.
Uh-huh.
And Art Gardner flew out and said no. And Fred said, then you're killing these people. These people will die. Of course, the people would have died anyway, probably. But the point was that Fred was making a pretty big point. I asked Galen about this. And Galen looked it up. And Galen wrote down everything.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote the most beautiful, sensitive, from the heart thing that you could possibly imagine someone in USAID saying. Essentially, not saying, you know, Fred's right, but saying, how can you not listen and how can you not be affected by these arguments?
Mm-hmm.
And my point is, from Fred's point of view, Galen would be the enemy, right? But Galen started out in IPS. Galen doesn't disagree with Fred. And somehow, I'd love to be able to find a place where I can understand not just the perspectives, but also that ignorance. You know, they're all struggling to do something. What is it? You know, I know what Fred's doing, thank God, you know. And the point is to create a space where what Galen was trying to do is heard too, because that's what the oral history is. It's people being given space to tell their story. When you take the space away, they look like fools, whether they're left or right. And you know, as an oral historian, you have an obligation to create the space for people to speak. So if I was writing a history of the IVS, for example, right, I'd have a point of view, I'd have probably a political agenda, as anyone else does, and I'd want to say something about it. And I may say, for example, the same things you're saying. Most likely, I mean, that's politically the way I'm constructed. But for this kind of oral history, you know, it's a special kind of task, and I hope it works out. And it's going to be interesting to see how it works, or whether we follow it up with a monograph. But by the way, you know, we're not interested in the history of the IVS. We don't want to do a history of the IVS. I want to do a history of the volunteers' experience.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was a monographic analysis, you know, about their experience and how they interacted. So, for example, there might be a framework which would be similar to yours, but it would be how each volunteer and each groups of volunteer reacted to facing those different challenges and how they were changed by that process, one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but by the way, you hit the nail on the head, and one thing that's pretty important, and that is that the people who were sent out changed over time. And the people who directed IBS changed over time. So there wasn't a single leadership throughout that period, and there wasn't a monolithic IBS cadre out there over that time. And the changes, like Fred, etc., the reason why Fred was out there was different from the reasons that people went out in 61. But what you'll find astounding is guys who were there in 61 left saying, this is going to be bad. I hope the United States never gets more involved in Vietnam than this.
Mm-hmm.
This is guys in 60, 61, 62. But there wasn't much of a war then. But even then, they said the same thing. USAID is crazy. A lot of these guys don't know their job. What are we doing here? We're interfering in these people's history. So in a sense, there are a lot of layers to this. And it's going to be interesting to see how it flushes out.
Yeah.
I mean, if you... No.
Yeah.
The theory being, if you knew Vietnam, you may have come to the radical position anyway in the end. Some did, some didn't. So.
Yes, yeah. Chris and Tia, Fred Branford, Don Luce, these are the people that I...
deconstruct all this.
Can you put this in here? Oh, burn, baby.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
It'll be cold.